thank you, Pat. And Pat, you're an eloquent speaker. You're articulate. It's. I feel edified just hearing. Seriously, you do a great job. First, when I went to life for inviting me back, I don't know how many times I've been, but it's always wonderful. And you often choose books that I've heard of or I haven't heard of, but then when I read them, I think, God, these are great books. And it's just delightful to be with a community that really is seeking deeper understanding. I was thinking about the fact that we're in election year, as I think people know, and I looked up some of my files 4 years ago. The group was doing a book called Sacred America, Sacred World. Some of you may remember that. And it was looking at what enlightened liberals and enlightened Democrats and enlightened Republicans would look like. And that was, I think when I spoke, it was a week or two before the election, and it was a dramatic time. So it's interesting to be coming back to this theme 4 years later when I probably fair to say things haven't gotten better. We could just maybe say that. So I've got some slides, and Tim is going to be my slide master. So I'll just do a click, and he'll walk through these. So click, Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, one element I just wanted to mention was the slides will be full screen, and Steve will be a small talking head in your screen at that time. And so if you'd like to make him a little larger, you should be able to drag one of the corners of the video if you're on a computer to make it a bit bigger. Or if you want to actually flip it and have a big Steve and a little slide, there should be a button at the top of your little video screen once I start the screen share that will allow you to invert the presentation. So the slides will be big and Steve will be small, or vice versa. So I know that that may be a bit much. Don't worry about it. You can just leave it and set it and forget it if you want. But if you're wanting a little bit bigger picture of Steve, that's one way to do it. So here they go, Steve.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. So I'm calling this, the title given, Political Implications of the Beatitudes, the Neuroscience and Practice of Loving Our Enemies. But I'd also subtitle it, The Elephant, the Rider, and the Gospel. I think it's a wonderful metaphor, the elephant and the rider. So click. So do this introduction, and then I'm going to focus primarily, of course, on the Brooks book, Love Your Enemies. And Elephant the Rider, of course, comes from the Hate book, but Brooks picks that up. So I'm going to just go back to that a little bit. Tim did a great job a couple weeks ago of taking us through some of that. And then I'm going to turn to the spiritual side of things. The gospel, this is about love your enemies, which comes from the Sermon on the Mount. But also Brooks himself mentions his admiration for the Dalai Lama. So I've got a little Buddhist piece in there. And then we'll turn and finish with seven practices to find a better way. And that's both for the world, but also for us, one might say neurologically and health-wise almost, of dealing with all the tension and anxiety and hope that we all have. Okay, next. So just real quick, looking at that theme again of righteous mind, the limits of fact and reason. And he has this great image of the elephant. So Tim, let's look at the elephant. There's the elephant, the automatic, emotional, visceral brain. And the rider is the conscious, verbal, thinking brain. And it's just a beautiful metaphor because it reverses what I would think. It's like a Jesus parable or something. It's actually the elephant that's driving the rider most of the time. And a lot of what the books and the theme is about is becoming conscious of that and not pretending we can get away from it, but embracing it in its complexity and in its opportunities. So he traced these values. So Tim, we can just kind of go through them that are there. The caring one, caring for other human beings, that's universal. Fairness, I think, is the next one. And according to the research, that's shared by folks, both progressive and conservative, or liberal and conservative. But then these next several, the next three in the research apparently indicates that these are primarily held for more folks for more conservative leaning. So Tim, if you want to let us see those. Authority, group loyalty, and purity. And I think those are really interesting. I think purity is a good one. Just make a little comment on that, because I think sometimes we can look at other people and say, boy, they have such fetishes about food, say, and the purity of food. But I know in Santa Barbara, say, if you don't have vegan options, or you know where your eggs came from, whether the chicken was free range or not, or if there are chemicals or genetically altered, there's still a desire for purity, and it just takes a lot of different forms. And then apparently in the research, they added this other one of liberty, which we can click on, and that for some folks, that sense of being completely free of authority is a strong value that intersects with those. So all those things are in us to varying degrees. So now let's go on. Okay, click. So these key themes, and I'll kind of talk through them. We can get that first one. Those righteous mind, which you just went through, this limit of fact, reason, and visceral reactions. There's so much in the last 30, 40 years in somatic psychology. A lot of you know a lot about that. But as we know, our body knows a lot more than we ever used to think. And so getting in touch with the body awareness as well as the mind is what we want to do. Next. The attraction and perils of contempt. The temptation, cortisol and adrenaline, and the shipwrecked rabbi. So I think it's a great theme about him really dwelling on this culture of contempt. And in my small group last week, I was thinking of it almost as like a seized candy, where it's pretty tempting to bite into some contempt. Because if I have contempt for somebody, I have a moral superiority, a feeling that, look at that terrible person. And that certainly makes me feel good. As Brooks points out, though, in the research, that apparently that's a short-lived high, that it's kind of addictive. The cortisol and adrenaline kind of tenses up, but afterwards there's a letdown and a kind of a sense of hollowness. And gosh, that contempt theme, you see it, of course, all the time right now in our politics and in our media. I just, the other day on Facebook, somebody was posting a video of Mitch McConnell, and it was kept repeating him walking up to a podium and tripping. And it was like just this idea that if you don't like McConnell, you want to see him trip and you want to laugh at him. And that temptation to kind of have that superior moment of judgment is strong. But I think for Brooks, something that we just have to really learn to stay away from. The shipwrecked rabbi, some of you may have heard this story, heard this a number of years ago. About the human tendency to want to have difference and superiority. And the story goes that there was a rabbi who had been shipwrecked on an island, and sometime after they came and found him, and there were two structures built on the beach. And they said, what are these? He goes, well, these are my two synagogues. And why do you need two? He goes, well, this is the one I worship in, and that one I wouldn't go in if my life depended on it. So there's this sense sometimes that we've got the right place, and it's really can be tempting to think, and those people, oh man, I would never go to that place ever. So that kind of contempt is something that really is a helpful thing to be alert to. Okay, next. Empathy and storytelling. Brooks does a great job of talking about the research all on storytelling and how facts facts and reason don't really work sometimes. But if somebody said, you know, well, let me tell you a story. I just told that little rabbi story that we tend to tune in. And I know friends of mine, faculty at UCSB and psych department talk about that. When we hear, I'm going to tell you a story, there's galvanic skin response. We get attentive. But we also are focusing, do we want to hang in there? Because after a minute or two, we think, I'm not into that story, and we shut down. But if we're engaged, there's a real high attentiveness that we experience, and it can be a wonderful thing. And for Brooks and the research, that the oxytocin is this empathetic hormone that gets released, which makes us more warm and connected to the person. And even after 10 years in the nonprofit world, I totally understand what he says about if you could have somebody from the cause you're representing tell a compelling and moving story, that's the best way to get support for your organization. The facts are helpful. Some people really like the facts, but for most of it, it's a memorable story. Okay, next theme. The importance of dignity. And I think that's a great theme. I love dignity. Several years ago when I was at hospice, I was up at a hospice conference in Canada, and there was a researcher there from university doing a lot of work on aging and dying. And his big theme he'd really developed was dignity, that no matter what's happening to me, if I don't have dignity, I'm an unhappy person. But if I can have dignity, even in the smallest ways, that's genuine, there's a sense of self-respect that I have, and a good feeling about myself. And so, as Brooks talks about, the great recovery, we call it the Obama recovery, I think, after the 2008 recession, a lot of people did better in the last 10 years, but a lot of people got left behind. And as we know, it's a lot of, as the research is, a lot of white males, especially in Rust Belt and rural areas, really haven't recovered where they were 10 or 12 years ago. And there's a sense that they're not worth anything anymore. And if they get that message politically, even if it's just implicit, there's a anger and a frustration there in not being given the dignity. I'm sure if one thing Hillary Clinton could take back was that comment she made about the incorrigibles or whatever it was. But that kind of, we'll get to that a little bit again, but dignity, it's a free thing we can give to each other, and it's a powerful, powerful thing. Next. The perils of identity, and he has that fun little story of the research about it back in the day when there was a lot of anti-Asian discrimination against Chinese, particularly California. Of course, that was very strong for many years. But a researcher would call some of these hotels and motels in the Midwest and say, would you be willing to have a Chinese guest come? No, we don't really want those kind of people here. But if a Chinese person showed up, and the researcher had some folks doing that, they would be very friendly, the hotel keeper, and would not have a problem. So that we can over-identify identity as a key. And I'd love to Brooke's story about the BYU briefcase, where he'd spoken at Brigham Young University, and as a thank you, they'd given him this beautiful briefcase with BYU on the side, and he didn't use it for a couple of years, and then one time he needed it, and his wife said, oh, take that BYU briefcase. So he carried it around, and he started realizing people would look at the briefcase and at the initials and look at him and just assume he's a Mormon. And he started really realizing he needed to decide if he was going to act like a Mormon or else really misrepresent Mormon identity. And even if you read that, it's a great story in the airport where he was going to go get a coffee and he had his briefcase. And he thought, well, people are going to say, look at that hypocritical Mormon. He's not supposed to drink coffee. There he is. So he gave up on the coffee. But so many times that identity, we can be too quick to use identity as a way to judge people. And we'll get a little bit more to that in a sec. Next one, Tim. And a big thing is if you don't feel like loving somebody, act as if you do, and you'll start feeling it. And that's a powerful thing, I think, from behavioral psychology, that we can actually make ourselves feel rather than wait until we feel all warm and hopeful. We can do those actions which are showing up and being places and doing some of the things in this material, and it'll start to change us, our chemistry and our behavior. Okay, so I'm gonna, next slide there, Tim. This is the one psychological, psychology. Okay, so we didn't get, is this
there's,
part B?
There's the, one more, finding a higher or deeper ground, that just popped up.
Okay, yeah, we had one psychological footnote. No?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah, no, that'll come up, but there was one more that just popped up on the bottom of the screen there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Great. Okay, good. Anyway, just finding a higher, deeper ground, faith and spirituality, and Brooks, and I'm going to get a little bit into that just in a sec, but for him, whether it's from a Christian or a Buddhist or lots of different angles, he really feels that that can be the call that we have to get to that higher or deeper ground and to engage some of these practices. Okay, thank you, Tim. Next one then. So just a little footnote before we get into this, because this has to do with this whole issue in the midst of COVID. And when I was at hospice, we were involved with a group called the Alliance for Living and Dying Well, and we had some grant money. And we were looking at, could we measure, we wanted to see if we could reduce the fear of death in Santa Barbara. And is there a way to measure that? Pretty interesting thing. And so a friend of mine at UCSB Psychology Brain Science Department put me in touch with some folks that do terror management theory. And what that is that it's coming from the work of denial of death back in the day, but that we have an unconscious fear of death. You may say, are you afraid of death? I'll say, oh, no. But if you can prod me, without me knowing it, it'll affect my behavior. So the classic story I always remember is that they took a group of judges, divided them into two groups, gave them each 20 questions. Group A just had pretty mundane questions about life and nothing very significant. The other group had, I think, 17 of those same questions, but three of their questions were different. And they were questions like, how do you think you will die? And then maybe a little later, what age do you think you will die? So one had these little prompts about death, the others didn't. And then they gave these judges these cases and asked them to judge and suggest what kind of a penalty they would give to the defendant. The ones who had the death stimulus in the questionnaire, which had nothing to do with criminal justice, it was just about yourself, they tended to be much harsher and longer sentences. So the idea is that if it's just back there, we tend to be more tribal, we tend to be quicker to judge and tense. That's COVID. You know, in the midst of this whole year, we've been in the midst of all the political craziness, there's a threat of death everywhere. And there's no way that can't, I felt from the beginning, this was gonna heat up a lot of our issues already and make things boil faster. And I think that's happening. And I hope we can get through it. Okay, so now let's go to higher and deeper ground. So first I want to start with, let's see. Okay, we can go next slide. Conversion of Arthur C. Brooks. Now this wasn't mentioned in the book, but I did some research on him and it is pretty interesting. So if we can have that next slide, Tim. So there he is, Arthur C. Brooks. As a self-described devout, happy Catholic, politically on the conservative side, definitely a free market kind of a person, but who has a strong sense of spirituality. He didn't get that from his family. When he was 15, he was a musician. When he was 15, he was on a tour with his band in Mexico City, and he came across, let's see the other picture, Tim. He came across Our Lady of Guadalupe. Age 15, without any expectation, he was kind of bored at the Basilica, but something happened to him. And he went back, and much to his parents' surprise, he started being interested in and developed this faith. Now, I've been to Israel and India, I've been to a lot of pilgrimage places, and some years ago I thought, well, the biggest pilgrimage place in the Western Hemisphere is the Guadalupe Shrine. And I went and spent a week there, really trying to feel what the devotion is, being in the presence of Our Lady Guadalupe. I didn't get that transfer of power and energy that sometimes you can get at pilgrimage sites. I saw it everywhere though, among all the people who are there, and I just realized this is what I'm going to appreciate is the devotion in Latin America to this wonderful image and story about Mary appearing. But what are the chances of a kid in a high school band from Seattle who has no religious background having some, Our Lady Guadalupe did something, something happened there. And that, I think, is really fascinating. So just want to give that as a background that I think he's aware that things can happen to us beyond all of our brain that can change our life. Okay, next. So Jesus' life and teaching, the Beatitudes and loving your enemy. So I want to begin by just saying that, we talk a lot about the love of Jesus and the love of God. But I think if we look more deeply into the Gospels, it's a complicated picture. We have that next slide. So I think that kind of a picture of the loving Jesus, of kids, and of course, they're all very Northern European looking and everything. But anyway, the birds are happy, the children are happy, and this is this loving Jesus. So if I'm going to love my enemy, is this the image that will do it for me? It might, but a little more complicated. Now I'm going to go on the other end of the spectrum of what the love of God looks like. So Tim, give me that other slide. Little contrast, as some of you may recognize this. This is the Mexican muralist Orozco, done in the 30s, and it's a famous piece called Christ Destroying His Cross. And basically the idea is that if Christ came back and saw the way in the background, you can see armaments and all kinds of destruction, that in his name, all of these terrible violence and destruction has been wreaked on the world. And I think the Buddha statue there is probably a sign of idols. But anyway, if Christ was there, his love would take that cross down, because that's not what he stood for. Okay, so two very polar opposite kinds of energies there. But next slide. Now this one, some of you, Word of Life, remember I did a whole piece on this. This is the 100 Guilder print by Rembrandt. We won't dwell on it a lot. But this is a whole scene from Matthew 17, and it represents all these different characters that are in that chapter. And the reason why I love this so much is that here's Jesus loving people, but it's in a lot of different ways. To the mother with the child, he's welcoming her. If we're to my left and I'm looking at my screen, there's some Pharisees over there. He's just loved them by challenging the way they're thinking. They didn't need to be coddled. They needed to be challenged. There's a young man just between the Pharisees. He's kind of got his hand like that. That's the rich young ruler. He was asking Jesus questions. What's love there is to challenge him. What do you think about your money? You need to think about that. Not in a mean way, but it wasn't, again, coddling. But other people around, he is embracing and touching and healing. So I think when we think of the love of God, the love of Christ, it's wonderfully complicated, and not to be complicated, but because it's so individuated to what different people need. There's different things I need in my life, in my spiritual journey, and sometimes it may be comfort and sometimes it may be challenge. And that's that kind of a love, I think, that is really at the heart of things. So having said that, let's just look quickly at the Beatitudes. And these, I think, for many of you, be very familiar, but we're going to briefly. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. As we all know, who wants to be poor in spirit? Poor in spirit means something's broken apart in our life. I feel emptied, and especially if we look at this from an ego point of view, things aren't working out, and I'm at the end of my rope. But the promise is, okay, when that breaks down, there is a spiritual reality that now can come into your life, and you'll find that that ends up being a blessing. Next one. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Who wants to lose people we love and mourn? If we don't mourn, if we have loss and don't mourn, some people maybe can get by, but for a lot of the human condition, a lot of us, if we don't have a chance to mourn, and that pain and sorrow is bottled up. There's a common phrase in psychology and hospice, pain isn't transformed, is transferred. And maybe you've heard that before. Pain that isn't transformed is transferred. So if I have grief and pain from my youth or other things, and I really worked it through, it'll come out, and often it'll come out in other ways that are destructive and full to me and other people. But if I can mourn, if I can own that and feel vulnerability that comes with mourning, then I can find comfort. The gap in my life can get filled with spiritual presence. Next one. Blessed are the meek or the humble, for they will inherit the earth. I think some years ago I was looking at that and I think what it can mean is that the opposite of humble is proud. And in our society, there's a lot of emphasis on owning things, owning your big property, owning your house. It's almost as if, and I, homeownership's a wonderful thing. I don't mean it in a bad way, but there's a sense that to feel good about things, there's an impulse in our culture that you have to own them and control them. But when we give up as we go into life, especially into nature, and we realize we don't own any of it, there's a sense in which it comes to us as a gift and not something that's in our grasp. And it's almost like we inherit the earth when, again, we're humble, when the ego is humbled, and we see these things that we don't own or control them, but look at what a beautiful world it is. Okay, next one. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Just think about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, John Lewis, people who their whole life for righteousness, for right relationship. And I'm sure both of them, there was so much work left undone when their lives ended. But there's a sense in which they found that they got it. they got connected into that struggle, which is a divine struggle, for both of them and the Jewish and Christian. And there was a sense of being filled with that community of other people, and to see people liberated, what that must be like, a sense of satisfaction. So we're not going to go through all these, but I just want to kind of set that. What I think they all have in common, blessed are the pure in heart, if we went on, the peacemakers, the persecuted, is a condition on finding a life beyond ourselves, beyond our ego. And as we know, when ego breaks or gets challenged, it's painful. But if we can open to the divine, to God beyond that, then we're blessed. We experience a quality of life that we'll never get if we're just living in our ego. So I think when Brooks is talking about love your enemies, it's reaching for that kind of power that's beyond our ego. I think of it too in that next slide, John 21. Yeah, there we go. John 21 is a scene at the end of John's gospel, and some of you will know it. It's where Jesus, in one of the Easter appearances, and he keeps saying to Peter, love me. Yes, Lord, I love you. Feed my sheep. Ask him again, do you love me? Yes, Lord, I love you. Tend my lambs. Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, I do. I do. Feed my sheep. And I thought about that some years ago when I was working on it. And I think part of that could be that if we want to love people, and we just work at a horizontal level only, sometimes people aren't that lovable. Go away being frustrated because there's a hidden sense of we want to connect. But if we love, in terms of the gospel, if we love God first, but then from that we love people, when things don't work out, it's God that we're connecting with first. And it makes us more free to accept whatever happens with people than if we're trying to cure or solve or help everybody. It's really that devotion first. And any of you who've done yoga would know the word drishti. Drishti is the term in yoga for if you're doing a balancing pose, don't just let your visual field meander. Find a focal point, a drishti. And it's often if you're doing a balancing pose, you find a spot on the ground in front of you. And there's something about having that drishti that calms and centers the rest of your balance. So I think in the core of the gospel is so much about the love of Christ, the love of God, which becomes our drishti, becomes our center. And out of that, we go out to love people. And if we have a good day of loving people, great. But if things don't work out, that's not where we're looking for our prime relationship. It's our divine devotion that's the source. Okay, so let's look a little Buddhism. Arthur C. Brooks talks about meeting the Dalai Lama and how important that was. In a basic good Buddha teaching is that true non-transactional compassion lies beyond our ego. And that being that I may feel like I want to care for somebody, and I hope they'll recognize that and care for me back. That's kind of a transactional kind of compassion or caring. And in Buddhism, sometimes they call that stupid compassion because it's just coming from our own self. But there is a power of compassion in the universe, in the spiritual realm, which is not attached that way. And it's not easy to access, but I think so much of Buddhist practice is to get to where that is accessed. So it's being present with suffering, but not attached to it. And in the hospice work I did, a number of us spent time up at the Zen Hospice Center up in the Bay Area. And so much of it is about grounding yourself when you're with people who are suffering. Even it's kind of like Pat's opening, common thing is if you're starting to get tense, you feel your feet on the ground, you feel your butt in the chair, and you breathe to let the energy be passing through you and into the ground and not holding the suffering that's in front of you. And it doesn't mean you're detaching from the person in front of you. It's just that you can be more present because your ego is kind of getting put aside. And one of the great practices I remember reading back in the 80s, the Dalai Lama recommends, if you want to practice and cultivate this, is you get two pictures for meditating. And one of them is somebody you love, perhaps a family member or your friend or something. But then the other picture you take, you put next to it somebody you don't like at all. And you do a daily practice of sitting there wanting to help, being open to cultivating, caring for both people the same, not like, oh, I like you, oh, not you, but how do I have a compassion for both? And that's quite a difficult practice, I think, but it's tapping into that elephant part of us that we resist caring for some people, but trying to cultivate that compassion for people regardless of how we judge them. Okay, little Buddhist footnote. I know Ernie Timmink is here in the crowd. He's a wonderful Buddhist teacher. So let's move on then from, those are some spiritual themes I wanted to lay out. Put the themes into practice. We're going to begin with something very domestic. How about in any relationships you may be in? We're going to have three tips for domestic tranquility from the New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. So here's a couple on the couch. And she's saying, I love you so, so, so much. And the caption is, force yourself to say, I love you. It makes the other person feel guilty, and that always works to your advantage. So Brooks is saying, but you kind of act as if you're feeling it. So just keep acting as if you love, and then it works to your advantage. Anyway, next one. How about going on a trip? Have you ever had arguments going on a long road trip? Well, what you do is before sitting on a long trip, you agree on what you're going to fight about in the car. So you don't just pick random things. Here's some suggestions. Who spends more quality time with the cat? Vegetarianism. Who does more housework? Name the world's best movie, book, or TV show. You can debate time and space. Parents. Should we have more or fewer dinner parties? But it's almost this negotiating thing. I want to have self-respect. I want to love you. Sometimes it's hard because we argue. Let's negotiate. It's kind of like Brooks would say, let's negotiate ahead of time on the issues we're going to discuss. But let's do that as a way to relation. Okay, anyway, let's move on then. Oh, I'm sorry, there's a toaster. Whoever carries most of the crumbs in the toaster gets the decrumbing job. I read that last week, and I'm the toaster user. My wife doesn't like the crumbs, but I cleaned them out. Because I realize I'm the culprit. So there's important ways just domestically we can practice good love and compassion. But let's go on to deeper things. Let's see here. So I think one thing that's important is to welcome complexity. so much of the book, which I like so much, is always playing liberal conservative, progressive conservative. But some of you know Rabbi Arthur Gross Schaefer. Some years ago, he came to our church in Goleta to talk about his situation in Israel. And he said, you know, I'm going to, before we answer any questions, I'm going to tell you about five different friends I have in Israel. And with each person, he went to a place in the room and told the backstory of that person. And then the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth. And they went kind of on a political spectrum of more conservative to more liberal, peace-oriented. So then he said, okay, what questions do you have about Israel? So somebody would ask a question, and he would go over to second spot. And he goes, my friend here, too, he would say, this is what Israel thinks. But if I went over here to my friend in spot four, five, they would have, and this is what they would say. But it demonstrated that people from different perspectives, it's their stories, and this is very much a Brooks theme, help develop our views. And rather than just two, we should be aware that there's more than just two options. Okay, next one. Well, that's okay. Presume the dignity of all persons. I think it's, I did a sermon, I shared it this summer with Word and Life folks. My dad, when he was in his late 80s, struggling to get in and out of a wheelchair, he looked at me and he said, it's still me in here. Even though he was not the proud, independent man he'd been so often, it's still him. And I think if we look at anybody knowing there's a me in there that's beyond the identities and all the other things, it helps us connect. And I just a little personal note, I think we should downplay the importance of a college education. And I've been involved in the school some. Not everybody needs to go to college. Sometimes we use that as a status thing. Did they go to college or not? I think the dignity of all persons, whether they're in the trades or educated, is a fundamental thing. I think politically, that's an important topic. Get out of our bubbles. Santa Barbara's a bubble, I think. I know for 11 years, we've gone out to Mount Shasta, to Siskiyou County. That part of the California is called Calabama because it's so conservative. But 11 summers being up there and getting to know some of the people, and this is a strong Trump area, very much seeing despair over the loss of the timber industry, seeing the healthcare, how it's not as good. I think it's really important when we can get out of our bubbles. And I'm grateful for the friends I do have on Facebook that I don't agree with. And I can look at some of the things that they say and I know them. I know their story. I know one recently, he posted, I don't understand what Biden's even for. And I know this person and I think, well, he's strong on defense. So I said, you know, gee, I think one thing I'm concerned about is the way the president right now isn't very respected by the military. And so that was my attempt to try to connect on the same values. And that's kind of getting out of the bubble that I'm in, because I'm just around people that I agree with. Share and listen to stories, a strong emphasis of Brooks. Back when I was starting in the with Islamic Society, one of their spokesmen, Hussam Musa, some of you will remember Hussam. I met him for the first time. This was after 9/11, Iraq War was going on. Things were tense, and I started talking to him. He'd grown up in Egypt. And I said, gosh, your English is so good. And he said, oh, well, I grew up on American cartoons when my dad was an engineer in Saudi Arabia. And I said, what cartoons? And he said, oh, my favorite was Mighty Mouse. And I'm like, Mighty Mouse, that was my favorite. Here I come to save the day. You know, if any of you remember that, sorry, it's one of my favorites. But there was that connection, you know, and this is just fundamental human relationships. Later, Hussam, I invited him to come to our church to talk about Arab views of the Iraqi war. And there was good crowd. One woman I know, very conservative politically. She asked some tough questions. Hussam just treated everything really well. The next day I called her and said, so what'd you think? And she said, no, I don't agree with one thing he said, but I wouldn't mind having him as my neighbor. And I think that kind of a connection, we may not agree, but we make that fundamental connection. I guess what Brooks is going at. And then personal training in love and warm-heartedness, an ongoing practice. How am I doing on time?
We're over 2 minutes, Steve.
Okay.
But we always have a little extra wiggle room if you want it. Yeah.
Okay. We can go through this pretty quick. Sorry. Okay, let's go into personal. Show the two slides. What I was going to do with this one is say, this is the Dodgers losing the World Series in 2017. That's the Astros who beat them. But then it turned out that the Astros were cheating, and I felt such contempt, and I'm trying to deal with that. So it's a juxtaposition. It's like what the Dalai Lama was saying. Juxtapose two pictures. Next one. If you wanted that kind of a meditation, might try that. The Dalai Lama would probably encourage us to try to do that. I'm not sure if I'm ready to do that, but you try to look and say, can I summon compassion and the love of God for both of these people? Okay, next. Okay, let's see. And then finally, I just want to look at heroes of civic engagement. In the midst of all this, there are some wonderful people in politics that I think are living up to what Brooks is talking about. Here's some. So let's look at some of these just quickly. This is John Adams, second president of the United States. I always think of him because he volunteered to defend the British troops from the Boston Massacre. Everybody, one of them, hung. He stood up for the rule of law and gave them their defense. And I think that's the best of America, where even if you don't, you're against these people and what they stand for, you stand up for their legal rights. Next. John Lewis, of course, respected by so many people on all sides of the aisle, that life of integrity, of loving God, loving your neighbor, loving your enemy. Next. The great friendship of Justice Ginsburg and Anthony Scalia, famous friendship based on opera and other things. They could disagree all the time, but they had a friendship. Next. John McCain, for all of his career, would always reach across the aisle. He and Biden had a great friendship, and as you may know, John McCain's widow yesterday just endorsed Biden. But even apart from the politics, just the ability to connect and respect people across the aisle. Next one. I never thought I'd see Mitt Romney in a Black Lives Matter protest, but there he was. Can't help but respect that. Next. That picture just slays me every time I see it. that's a picture to meditate on. And so let's just finish up. Let's just show the last slide. I think I've already mentioned that. Coda, real quick, democracy is about more than voting. It's also about self-restraint. Some years ago, I heard a speaker come back from the Soviet Union as it was breaking up, and he said, you know, they're talking about the importance of voting. He said, how many of you out there are involved in at least 5 nonprofits? And people are like, that's a lot. Well, talk about your church, the YMCA, Scouts. Pretty soon, all the hands were up. And he said, a lot of democracy is knowing how to organize and do work together honorably and honestly. And just voting isn't the only thing in democracy. It's also about all of that. What we almost take for granted of how we deal things, even word in life, the way it's organized and handled. And then finally, I've led retreats and I've had people say, yes, I think compassion, empathy are really important. But if I'm fighting for my farm worker constituency, I really want to win. I don't want to just in the end feel kumbaya with the people that I'm against. I want to respect them, but I also am not going to give up on the issues that I'm passionate about. So don't let compassion and empathy diminish the will to pursue justice and peace. Hopefully they can work strongly together more so than apart. Okay, I think that's it.
All right, Steve. Well, do you have any guiding questions for us as we head to breakout groups? That you'd like people to toss around for about 15 or 20 minutes? If so, I'll type them in the chat.
You have those two. Judith or Pat, do you have those two? I'd send them in.
Yeah, in the document that I got, I didn't see yours filled in. Pat, do you want to try to unmute? There you go.
Steve took some time with these questions. We actually sent emails back two or three times about them. They're good questions. Question number one. In Love Your Enemies, the author encourages us to share the gist of our life story in a few words. His example is, a lucky man dedicated to lifting others up and bringing them together. That's his life story in just a few words. So for our first group response, take a moment to get a feel for your own life story and then share it in 20 words or less. And we have to stop after 20 words. You can count them off. But what's the gist of your life story? It will tell you a lot about what he's been talking about. Then question number two, think of a friend or relative who has different political views from yours. Reflect on what their life story may have led, on what in their life story may have led them to those views. Share that story and insight with each other. So number two is the story behind the story with someone you know who doesn't agree with you. And what insight does that give you? So two wonderful questions, a gist of our own life story, and then remembering how we're dealing with somebody who differs from us.
Great, thank you, Pat.
Wonderful friends, you will be assigned to a breakout room. The questions that Pat just presented are in the chat for you right there to refer to. And we'll come back probably in about 15 minutes or so this time so that we can get on track with time. And so we'll see you at about 11:15. So here you go. You have to accept this invitation as it gets sent to you, and you'll be assigned to a group of 3 to 4 to discuss these questions. This is just a time to have some question and response with Steve. Again, if you would like to ask a question in the chat, you're welcome to just type it either to me personally or to everyone. Or if you'd like to ask Steve the question out loud, you can hit the raise hand feature by clicking on participants. And then on the right, bottom right, there should be a raise hand button. And I can come and unmute you and so that you can talk to Steve personally. So we're just going to wait for somebody to chime in here. All right, I see that Mary Beth has raised a hand here. So Mary Beth, go ahead.
Thank you. Steve, thank you. I have a question. In our group, we each have family members with whom we cannot have conversation about the political situation. And I'm a mediator, and I can't find language to mediate my own conversations. Because, and I've lived, my father, who was a Kennedy Democrat, became brainwashed through Fox News. And there's this wonderful movie called The Brainwashing of My Dad, which really shows how this works. And I have this feeling that there is something more profound going on that's pulling us further and further and further apart, where I can't find language. We can't find language to connect. And I'd love for you to speak to that, because it seems deeper than just basic disagreement and what to do about it.
Gosh, I wish I had. I think these times do feel deeper and darker than other times, I think. We were just talking in our group, if the president is reelected, the prospect of 4 more years of, and I'm not saying politically, I'm just saying psychologically, socially, the strain is immense. And so I guess for me, I really appreciate Brooks's thing about trying to keep, I know the relatives that we don't see things eye to eye, but are related. I try to pray for them. I'm not praying God, would you change their mind? But just, you know, just keep seeing them and praying for them. And I think avoiding contempt and speaking truth carefully on those common values that we may try to share. I mean, according to the research, that we have some basic values, trying to look for those. It's such a hard time. I don't know if anybody else has some ideas. I'll just say, in my small group, I did say, to me, the heroes, looking at people like John Lewis and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, where society was when they started, not everything was fixed by any means when they died, but how they continued to stick to their integrity and respecting other people. And I think if they can do it, I can try, you know?
Steve, I've got a thought about that. Yeah.
Sure.
Mary Beth, does your dad use Facebook by chance?
No, my dad died in 2014.
Okay.
This is way predates this
sure.
president.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think I did mention this in the Q&R session from session one, but there's a whole history to the development of this really far right-wing conservatism that is, I think, being perpetuated by Fox News. And it started really in the late 70s, early 80s. And it's evolved into this kind of Frankenstein rightism, which, again, as I mentioned at the outset, is not indicative of the best of the conservative moral matrix, but actually is sort of a Frankenstein version of it. And so the apocalyptic sense, or that heaviness that we all feel, is a part of this evolution, this new evolution that's about 40 years old. And so there's that. But then, you know, I do want to just mention that social media and the media has complicated that and made it, it's made it easier for people to not have to look across the aisle by getting people into silos. And this happens on Facebook. And there's a documentary that I like to bring up, and Judith and others have heard me say before, but called The Social Dilemma, that's on Netflix right now. I would recommend that anybody watch that. And it's almost like, it was an accident, actually, in terms of the founders of the social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. When they had to monetize their platforms, they created this monster algorithm that started to separate people out into these silos, you know. And so when not only is that happening in every part of our internet engagement with one another, but also the medias that are skewed left or right have picked up on those sensibilities and started speaking to them, it creates this new phenomenon that pushes people apart and pushes us into these different directions. So I do feel just a sense with you of, you know, what's going on. I mean, there's something else going on now that's different, but I think if we really do our investigation work, we'll see that there's a cause and there's a real history to that, how we got here. So, you know,
I agree. And I put the movie in the chat because it documents it, starting back with the Nixon debates. Mm. And I think something you spoke to, and it shows it historically unfolding. So thank you.
Right. Yeah. Cool. Steve, hey, we've got another question here from Yoli. And she wants to hear you maybe unpack the sentence from your coda that says, "Don't let compassion and empathy diminish the will to pursue justice and peace." Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yes, it's Tim.
Yeah.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Yoli. Good to see you.
You too. Yeah. So on the coda, you had a statement that says, "Don't let compassion and empathy diminish the will to pursue justice and peace." And I don't know if it's because English is not my native language, but it seems to me that when you have compassion and empathy, the more you raise the will to pursue justice and peace. So am I misunderstanding somewhere?
Thank you, Yoli. I think I very poorly phrased that, and I apologize. It came out of it at La Casa before the debris flow. Last couple of years we were there, we were developing a thing called the Center for Nonprofit Renewal, which we were gonna some foundations in Los Angeles to become a place where people in really frontline, hardworking, burned out nonprofit folks in LA could come to La Costa and get renewed. So we started doing those programs and they were starting to get traction. And I remember at one, it was all on mindful leadership. And on the last night, one of the folks said, you know, I do want to feel compassion. I do want to feel a oneness with people, but I don't want that to diminish my commitment to the causes that I'm fighting for. And so I think my CODA, that wasn't phrased very well. I think they ideally would work together, compassion and empathy with peace and justice. But I feel like, I guess sometimes it's such a delicate balance of how do you do that? How do you stand up strong and not alienate people? I mean, you know, how?
Okay, got it. Again,
I just think, I look to John Lewis, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, people like that, who their whole life were able to hold all those together. But never give up creating good trouble for people, you know?
Okay, all right, got it.
And thank you, though. I would definitely reword that last sentence.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
All right, Catherine Weisenberg has her hand up here.
I just wanted to, I have a 23-year-old daughter, and I know that a lot of us are grandparents or have older, younger adult children. And so for me, my daughters really started having these conversations and feeling frustrated and whatever. So it's not just us that are concerned. So I take hope in that the next generation, even if this passes around, that they're watching and they are going to be the seeds. We are planting seeds because they're seeing this. And also just that, and I encourage my daughter, have friends, have conversations with your friend, because there's a lot of younger people that don't vote, aren't registered voters. So I just see that, you know, in COVID and here we are at home, that is an avenue to talk to. Perhaps across the aisle may not be a conversation that you can have, but as an elder, have that conversation with your grandchildren or your nieces or nephews or whoever it might be, and encourage. My daughter is on social media, to use that platform to try to encourage other people in their age group. Anyway, so I just want to offer that, because this just happened in the last week and it's been really powerful to see. And I think that, you know, youth can move things. That, so anyway, I just across the aisle and within the family. But not to your really opposition relatives, if those conversations arose. So,
you know, I know Lois Capps is speaking in a couple of weeks, I think, and I remember she spoke at a hospice event and talked about, after, as we all know, she lost her husband, but then also a daughter to cancer. And when she was in Congress, there was a support group of people, I guess, largely women legislators, I think, who had lost children. And they would meet once a week, I think like 7 a.m. And she said the bond from that common loss was so strong that their party identities got left at the door because they had shared that heartbreak, you know? I think about that sometimes, again, a la Brooks, of trying to find out where we have common ground. Other comments or anybody?
Christiane.
Yeah. Christiane, yeah, go ahead.
I read something very disturbing yesterday, how the Chinese in Tibet are accelerating deportation of Tibetans to China to relocate them and basically annihilate the culture. They take them out of agriculture and put them into low-paying factory jobs in China. And it reminds me of the Dalai Lama 5 years ago said he had great doubts that his stance of compassion and nonviolence did anything to help his people. If anything, the culture is being very methodically destroyed. So, and on a, some level, I feel something like that is happening here when I see the post office being dismantled, words being distorted, statistics being distorted. It creates a feel like, okay, love and compassion, empathy is great, but should not diminish the will to pursue justice and peace. You know, I think sometimes action is absolutely necessary of some kind. I don't know. You know, it's disturbing.
Yes, it is.
So voila, what's the solution?
Well, I certainly, you know, maybe somebody else, but I think with, it's really lost to have John McCain gone, because on things like human rights, the imprisonment of people, having been a prisoner himself and a conservative Republican, he was a wonderful spokesperson for human rights all around the world. And he, we just don't have the voices right now like that. But hopefully.
May I say something?
Mm-hmm. Hey, Deb.
Hey, Steve. Thank you. Great conversation. I guess we were sharing resources, and one that helps me is factcheck.org, a nonpartisan website that analyzes things. And of course, you have to be open to wanting to hear both sides, so it's not for everyone. But I guess in terms of action that we're speaking about, there is a documentary that has come out by Stacey Abrams, All In, on the voter suppression history. But when she was interviewed just this week on Amanpour, I found her leadership and ability to focus in on just that one issue of getting access to the voting polls just so inspiring. And so I'm eager to see that documentary and continue to do whatever we can to get the vote out, I guess. So that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, thank you, Deb.
Yeah, we've got a hand up, Steve, from Marianne Evans. So Marianne, if you want to unmute yourself, feel free to chime in. Okay.
Thank you so much, Steve, for your talk today. And I think one thing that kind of struck me that you said, I don't even know who it was regarding, but so much of what we're talking about is on this horizontal axis of our everyday world, and we get so overwhelmed with the sense that we're feeling paralyzed, that what can we do as individuals? And I think because this group is so profoundly spiritual and deeply involved in transformation of our consciousness, that perhaps on an individual basis, we can begin to look at the stance or the perspective from which each of us come, finding our own center, our own grounding, and our own working from our heart stance. We can't change the world as an individual, but I think each of us in our own way can come from that stance of compassion, just in every interaction that we have. Every action that we do, it will make a difference. It will be like a ripple that spreads out. And I know that, and Tim, what you were saying about this, you know, 40 years, George Lakoff spoke to this many, many years ago. He was here in Santa Barbara a while back and talked about the think tanks that have been, you know, this is a culmination of a 40-year plan by hyper-conservatives. And we're seeing the culmination of this. And it's terrifying. And so we can't let ourselves become a victim of our own fear and terror, because we shut down and we go into our amygdala and all of our cortisol and all the neural transmitters get, you know, thrown out there, and we become paralyzed. So we have to move back into our own contemplative stance and our own practices so that we become transformed as agents of this compassion. And then our work will have an impact. So I think we need to bring it back to that vertical axis of how we can impact that horizontal plane of all that stuff that's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll just add a comment. I think in the at some of the hospice training I had, the teacher, the longtime Zen meditation teacher, but he talked about the namaste. I think a lot of you know the little hand gesture. And he said one root of it, I'm not sure if this is true for the Sanskrit, but anyway, is that it's compassion met by wisdom, and you hold them together. Because sometimes it's all compassion and not very sophisticated, or we can be really smart but no compassion. And the real importance of holding those, I think in the Gospels when Jesus says, be wise as serpents and innocent as doves, it's that same kind of a thing. So I think we need to cultivate compassion and love, but also street smarts and strategic thinking and civilized assertiveness, you know, because I think sometimes compassion can just make us kind of fold, but I think both of those are critical to hold, literally hold them together.
All right, I think we've got time for one more. So Catherine Dean, I see you have your hand raised. Feel free to unmute.
I always get labeled Catherine. I just saw your quote that you put up in the chat, Tim, and then I'd written down during Steve's wonderful talk, democracy is about more than voting. And I actually, when he said that, I got up and got my copy of Democracy in America by de Tocqueville off my shelf. Probably a good to reread at this time, but I was reminded that one of the key findings de Tocqueville had in trying to figure out how democracy was working in America, where it hadn't worked anywhere well else in the world, hardly, was social organizations. Americans were a country of social and civic organizations, and people learned to work together and to work in a democratic way together. And I think that that has been weakened in recent decades. And probably social media's got something to do with that, I suspect. But in terms of looking ahead, you know, groups like this, but also groups, other social groups and civic groups belonging to them and interacting with other people and forming those relationships and those understandings, I think is critical to moving forward and healing our country.
Yes, I sure would agree. And I think a lot of you know David Brooks and follow him. And a lot of his emphasis now is on local organizations, self-organizing at the community level. And I think, like I said about America, that quote years ago, that it's not just voting, it's about knowing how to, it's about self-restraint and mutual respect. And whether it's the Little League, you know, treasurer, doing the books right or following the right rules of interaction at a county hearing. That self-restraint is really fundamental to democracy. And I think I'm gratified that after the president said he may not regard the election results, McConnell and a lot of them said, no, this is the way, you can't go there. This is, America's about this self-restraint. You respect the process and you honor even if you disagree. So I think I agree with you, Michael, that what de Tocqueville saw is what the core of democracy is. Voting is a huge part of that, but it's also our inner and interpersonal.
Thank you, Steve. Okay. Well, I think we're about time. So Pat, do you want to unmute yourself and come in and close it up?
Yes, unmute.
You're good.
You're unmuted.
Am I good? All right. What a morning. Thank you, Steve, for this mind-opening, heart-strengthening morning. You've really managed to give us the core and the meaning of Brooks's remarkable book, and you've translated it into real-time attitudes and behavior that we can all try out in our own lives. We haven't been hearing about love as a fuzzy and sentimental emotion here, but as something clear and bracing. Mm-hmm. In his Summa Theologica, St. Thomas Aquinas said, to love is to will the good of the other. Now, he wasn't talking about the others in our group. He was talking about the other, the opposites. He went on to say, love is not sentimental, not restful in illusions, but it's watchful, alert, and ready to follow evidence. That love seeks what's real, the way our lungs crave air.
Wow.
In order to dismantle this culture of contempt that we and our mass media have created, we're called to that standard of practicing love. It listens with the heart first, but in the same moment, it calls us to think clearly and to look at the facts. When heart and brain function as a single whole, we have enough intelligence suddenly released to be able to see that there is common ground here where we can respect each other even in the midst of disagreement. Next week, Dr. David Rico will introduce the main source book for this series, The Healing the Heart of Democracy. He'll step off from Steve's work this morning to guide us in developing the capacity to hold our tensions in life-giving ways. It's a first step in opening ourselves and our damaged culture to healing. Well, any final words from Steve or Judith or Tim? Nope.
Love, in that case, said Pat, and the Aquinas quote is beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
there was a question to give us access to that quote. So is it possible for you to maybe forward that to Judith to send out with the next Word in Life email?
Absolutely. That'd do that. Great. Thanks.
Yeah. And
all right, everybody.
I also added a book in the chat. I don't know if you all have heard of the book Bowling Alone, but it's a great, yeah, work. Steve's nodding his head. So by a Harvard professor on, you know, what's going on in our continued societal separation. So.
And that should go out, I hope, on our website. And again, I urge everyone to check in on that website, wordinlife.us, one single word, because I think these resources will appear there. So thanks to all of you for making this a memorable morning. We'll look forward to seeing you next Thursday, October 1st.
Great.
Have a good week.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Steve, very much.
Peace, y'all.
Peace.
And see you soon.
Bye.
Peace. Bye. Yeah.